You're listening to Upfront on KPFA. I'm Antonia Yuhas. When Donald Trump took office, the ceiling for refugees the U.S. was prepared to welcome each year was 110,000. Trump lowered that amount to 45,000, though significantly fewer were actually allowed in. But Secretary of State Mike Pompeo just reduced the number even further, saying that the United States will allow no more than 30,000 refugees into the country in the coming year. The International Rescue Committee aid organization lambasted the lowering of the refugee ceiling. It released a statement saying, "The United States is not only abdicating humanitarian leadership and responsibility sharing in response to the worst global displacement and refugee crisis since World War II, but compromising critical strategic interests and reneging on commitments to allies and vulnerable populations, including religious minorities and those whose lives are in danger because they assisted U.S. troops and U.S. missions overseas." Our guest today is Roberta Gately. She is an author, a nurse, and a humanitarian aid worker who has served in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Balkans, Darfur, Kenya, among other locations. She has often served in war zones and immediately following first a Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, then U.S. invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, among other war zones. She's the author of two novels, Lipstick in Afghanistan, released in 2010, and The Bracelet, released in 2012. Her latest book is a memoir. It's entitled Footprints in the Dust, Nursing, Survival, Compassion, and Hope with Refugees Around the World. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Antonia.
So I want to start, you wrote this memoir to talk about refugees and to put a human face on refugees. You start each chapter with a name of an individual whose story you want to make sure we learn about. And you say in the information about the book that that's really the goal, to humanize not only your own experience, but even more importantly, the lives of refugees who you've worked with throughout the world for decades now. And I wanted to start by putting this in the context of this latest anti-refugee moment, anti-immigrant moment that we're in the United States, and to get your response to this most recent change in policy announced by Secretary Pompeo.
So I have to say it's a disappointment that we will take in less. But last year, as you know, we only took in 33,000. We've taken in, I think the most we've taken in a year is about 60,000. But I do have to say the U.S. has always been first to respond, our government, and along with individuals, either donating or going overseas to help. And since 1980, the U.S. has taken in 3 million of the world's 4 million refugees since that time. So this is a bit of a setback, but I still think that the U.S. will step up to the plate. I'm not sure that this number will last. I think I actually do have hope that it will go up higher. And I hope that when people read this book, that they'll really be able to see the refugees.
And do you think that is, in your motivation for deciding to write a memoir this time, did you see that as something that was lacking in the way that we've been talking about refugees in the United States? And the book comes out at the very beginning of October, so a brand new memoir. I guess, why this time, why right now did you decide that it's important for more people to understand the plight of refugees?
Well, I actually started writing this on my very first aid trip. Every night, by the light of a candle or a flashlight, I wrote the day's events and the people's stories. And in Iraq in 2003, a New York Times reporter told me I should write a book. And that's when I actually put this story into a computer. The novels followed kind of serendipitously, and they were published first. But I do want people to see refugees. If we only see those tiny snippets on the news and we're caught and engaged for just a moment, and then they're on to the next story, we don't know those people. I think that it's in that knowing that we can come to understand that they are very, very much like us.
And You tell many different stories throughout this book. Let's start by letting listeners know that you are an emergency room nurse. You were an emergency room nurse in Boston when you first decided in the mid-80s to head off to Afghanistan after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. So can you talk about your skills as an emergency room nurse and why you chose to apply them abroad?
Well, as an ER nurse in Boston's busy trauma center in 1986 and beyond, we were actually able to do anything. We could improvise, treat stab wounds and gunshot wounds and a myriad of other injuries on a dime. I felt confident in my assessment and intervention skills. I knew what to do. I knew how to do it. And I'd always wanted to do aid work, I think like so many nurses and physicians, but the time was never right. And I came home from work one hot evening in 1986, turned on the air conditioning in my apartment, grabbed a cold Diet Coke, and flipped on my television to the news. And there was a really startling, gripping pictorial about the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan. And the reporter ended his story. He was well-dressed in a driving rain and, you know, appropriately dressed for the weather. And behind him was a woman and her three children under a makeshift little hut of a threadbare blanket held up by sticks. They themselves were stick thin. It was the most gripping thing I'd ever seen. I actually sat straight up. And as soon as he said, "They need medical help," I wrote down the number and made the call. And that was the start of it all.
And then tell me what it's been like. You've been in Afghanistan and at the Afghan-Pakistan border. You were in Afghanistan again after the U.S. invasion in 2002, in Iraq after the U.S. invasion in 2003, in Darfur in 2004. Tell us what it's like to be providing these services in these different locations.
I think it's only retrospectively that I can actually look at that objectively. When I'm in the thick of it, I live the way the refugees do. And it's, you know, I adjust pretty quickly and always have. So for me, within an hour, it's just like being at home, trying to manage the patients, triage the wounded. But it's in looking back that I can see the starkness of it. Working with people who have nothing is the most humbling, most satisfying work in the world. People are so grateful for everything. Here in the U.S., if I go out to the waiting room and have to explain to people that there's a wait, people are angry. And I would feel the same. That's not to, to cast any aspersions on them. But in Afghanistan or Darfur, people would wait for hours to see us. And that really, really made me stop and understand that we weren't just providing great medical care for people. We were providing that vital human connection that they, and they knew that they weren't forgotten.
Talk about Afghanistan in 2002.
Afghanistan in 2002 was, in a word, the most challenging and the most gratifying place to be. I went with a French aid group, and their mantra is always stay neutral, as all aid groups are. But they were very strict about, you know, don't go near the soldiers, they're invaders. And there were American soldiers embedded near me in central Afghanistan. I went there on an Irish passport. The New York office had told me to make sure nobody knew that I was an American. It was still dangerous. And I spoke in an Irish brogue for 6 months, courtesy of mimicking my grandmother when I was young. So people thought I was Irish. So there was, for me, that level of intrigue. But the level of satisfaction of spending 6 months in one area, in one province, we went out on mobile clinics, was the most meaningful experience I've had. I really got to know the people. I still call some of them my friends. Believe it or not, I keep in touch with a few on Facebook. It's hard to explain. They've had so little. When I first went there in 2002, the maternal mortality rate was literally the worst in the world. And every 20 seconds, a woman died of childbirth or pregnancy complications. And to see how that's changed over the years is gratifying. I hope that people will read the book, not to plug it, but it's hard in many ways to explain the experience without those stories. This most important to me was a little boy named Hamid, who had a congenital hip defect. And he was a little child who walked barefoot on makeshift crutches along the stony roads of Bamiyan. We raised money and had him sent to Kabul, where his hip was fixed. He came back to Bamiyan, a smiling, seemingly healthy little boy. It was the most, I was the most grateful to the powers that be ever to see that change and to have been a part of it. And sadly, Hamid was septic and he died within a few weeks of his coming home to Bamiyan. That's a story that will always just wrench at my gut.
Well, and also, you know, each of these locations are war-torn locations and people being dislocated as a result of war. And you were often set up at refugee camps for people fleeing from conflict. Can you describe what the camps are like that you worked at? Maybe we'll switch to Iraq in 2003, and what the camps are like, and what, you know, what emotional condition in addition to physical conditions you're confronting with refugees who are fleeing these war-torn events.
Well, Iraq was a little different. There really we were ready. I went with the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. The UN came in shortly after we arrived there, and there weren't really traditional refugee camps. The nomads had their own camps, but most people were staying with family or friends, or sometimes out in the elements. Iraq was different for me because I remember in preparing to go to Iraq and doing the research and making sure we were ready to go right in once the soldiers did. What struck me was that the U.S. had announced we would invade, but never gave a date. So as my stomach churned for that, I began to wonder about the children and families who were sitting in Iraq, wondering when the bombs and the invasion would start. And I thought the kind of resilience that would be required to come back from that would be phenomenal. And it really was. When we first arrived in Iraq, we were greeted, and we went in right behind the soldiers. We were greeted literally like the soldiers were after World War II. And I know that sounds incredible, but we were when we walked down a street, we were applauded. We were like movie stars. And that's because their electricity had been cut off, their food supplies, they had no jobs. And they believed that we brought with them, as the humanitarian aid workers, the promise of all of that, plus a great successful future. And unfortunately, as the weeks and then the months wore on and things actually only got worse, the electricity wasn't back, the clean water wasn't back, people began to resent us. And that was the first time in my humanitarian aid experience that I understood that we wouldn't always be quite so welcomed.
And what were the services that you were needed for then in Iraq at that time? And how long were you there on that mission?
I was there for 3 months. And we were needed because the infrastructure, actually since the first Gulf War, had really been gutted because of the sanctions placed on Iraq from earlier wars. They didn't have the parts or the mechanical information to fix cars, to fix machinery. Their water system was crumbling, healthcare, So we were ready to support and open health clinics or reopen health clinics, which had been decimated during the bombing and the invasion, and to help clean up the water. The water was bacteria laden and had to be boiled before use. We also wanted to help with the logistics of getting kids back to school, getting patients the medicine that they needed, clearing roads, making sure the food supply was healthy. There's a lot to do, and it takes a lot of preparation.
And then there were areas where you have been serving where it is a more traditional, as I was describing it, the influx of refugees, you know, fleeing war zones. Can you talk about some of the stories of providing care and who you were, what the conditions for like were like for the people you were providing it in those examples?
I think the starkest example of that is Darfur. In 2004, International Rescue Committee was one of the first groups to go in. The government of Sudan had started an attack on northern Sudan in an area called Darfur, an area of farmers and nomads. And they'd started inexplicably bombing this population. It was kept pretty quiet until late 2003, when word got out. The president of Sudan allowed small groups of aid workers in. I'm sure he thought it was for his, he'd gain financially from this. And once he let us in and we were able to see the devastation, people actually were fleeing hideous bombing by the government. And they were fleeing with nothing. They were fleeing barefoot and creating, literally in the blazing sun, ragtag refugee camps. Just bits of paper or plastic held up by, you know, thin branches of wood. They had no food, no water, no medicine. It was the bleakest of surroundings.
And what was the, you know, the condition of the people who were coming? What was their emotional state and their physical state as they were arriving?
They had literally just escaped after seeing husbands, children, mothers, wives killed or butchered or burned. Their stories were staggering in their atrocity, and just these people were tortured. It was awful. And Sudan was very quick to say that we could neither interview nor photograph those people. And IRC, to their credit, wanted to hold to that that mandate. But I'm a nurse, and I was also writing for nursing journals then. And I knew that the only way to tell a story was with pictures. And with talking to people. So I would sneak out my camera and get pictures and talk to people and write down their stories. And then one day a government official came to visit us, and he was angry, and he was shouting about, he'd heard that there was a woman interviewing people. And my camera that was in my pocket started clicking away. But he never heard it. He was so enamored of the sound of his own voice. He just kept going on. And he didn't know I was the person, and I was just shaking my head. But I'm glad that I did that. I'm so glad I told their stories and heard them. And I think that it was important to those people to know that somebody would do that.
I was recently, a couple of years ago now, at the Macedonian border with Greece, with refugees from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Syria, who were trying to make their way out of Greece into Macedonia and onto Europe. And I would say the one thing that was most shocking to me at the refugee camps there, which wasn't being reported, is something that you've touched on. In the locations where you were, is just the disproportionate number of people who are there who are women and children. And the UN had estimated by this point that 70% of the people trying to get from Greece into Europe, but being stopped at the border, were women and children. And seeing, you know, women who are pregnant, women who are giving birth in the camps, women, you know, small newborn babies and toddlers in the camps. And I think that just that, you know, sort of the necessity of the needs of women and pregnancy and birth and children just doesn't seem to be translated enough out of these areas. And I'm wondering if that's something that you've also experienced in your aid work.
It definitely has. And historically, it's been 80% of refugees that are women and children. And we've already always targeted our programs to them, focusing really on pediatrics and maternal health and female health. Men are often left behind to fight or to protect their homes or have already been killed, and families now led by women are on their own. And you're right, they don't often focus on that. The UN certainly does. They have the statistics. They're the ones who lead us through all of that. I'm not sure why it doesn't make it to the news, because those are the most thoughtful stories, I think, that will really catch people's interest. It's what first caught my interest and my eye in 1986. It was that woman with the doe eyes and her children huddled in the rain, staring into my television screen as I sat comfortably. And that's what spurred me to action.
And then, you know, at this time where we do have a strong anti-immigrant, anti-refugee sentiment, at least at the head of the country, hopefully not spreading through the rest of it, what do you think is most important for Americans to understand about what it is that refugees are fleeing and why they might be needing to come here? What are the stories that you want to make sure we're hearing and understand?
I think that people are fleeing circumstances that are hard to describe, because truly they're unimaginable to people in the U.S. We sit in our comfortable homes with electricity and food, too much food, and it's hard to imagine that people have nothing. But I tell people, imagine a population the size of Rhode Island fleeing with nothing, with absolutely nothing. No water, no clothes, no medicine, just the clothes on their backs. No money, and going into unknown dangerous territory where somebody is trying to kill you. It's that kind of terror is unimaginable. And I think that we have to remember first that we are all in this world together. We have to reach out a hand and help.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's important that we then, you know, open that eye, and I think this is how we will make ourselves a more refugee-friendly nation again, is to see that here in the United States, because, of course, there are many places across the United States where people day in and day out don't have electricity, are essentially in war zones, are suffering without health care, are suffering from trauma, and particularly low-income communities of color across the United States. And right now, with storms raging across the country more often and more often, more people are now being forced to suffer these extremes of extreme weather. And those conditions are bringing around the world more refugees to the United States. And now not just war refugees, but climate refugees. And the more that we, as you say, you know, open our eyes to see who is at our doorstep, the more generous, hopefully, we will be. So I really appreciate you bringing these stories to the fore and writing them down for all of us to read and study and understand better and open our hearts to. And our guest, again, Roberta Gately, is an author, a nurse, a humanitarian aid worker serving in many war zones across the world. She's the author of two novels, Lipstick in Afghanistan and The Bracelet. And her latest book, a memoir, is Footprints in the Dust, Nursing, Survival, Compassion, and Hope with Refugees Around the World. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.